Okay, welcome back. Remember, let me remind you of where we are. The big picture is that in physics, quantum gravity is the frontier. And as far as we got for sure is that we put quantum field theories on curved spacetime. What's still missing is quantizing these spacetimes. But putting quantum field theory on a curved spacetime is as far as we got for sure in that effort of finding that unifying theory. And what we are doing now in this course is we are in the middle of doing just that, quantum field theory on a curved spacetime. How can we do it? How do we know that it's possible? And remember this strategy that we pursued. We started with the Hamiltonian formalism in special relativity. And then we said, well, we want the Hamiltonian formalism in general relativity. But how? How can we guess, for example, what the canonically conjugate momentum field is, pi? It's not just phi dot, but what is it? So what we did is we went then over to the Lagrangian formalism, where covariance was easy. Quantization is hard, but covariance is easy. And we used that to generalize to general relativity and curved spacetimes. And then we did the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian framework, where we then found out, the canonically conjugate momentum field pi is given by such and such expression in terms of phi, which involved time derivatives of phi, but also spatial derivatives of phi. So now, in principle, we are ready to just quantize the theory. But the big drawback of the Hamiltonian formulation is that covariance, even if it is there, is not obvious, because the Hamiltonian singles out the time direction. So what we did last time was to use the Darboux theorem to tell us, yes, there is a solution. At least if the spacetime is globally hyperbolic, we can solve it. But we didn't completely solve the issue, because we only showed, yes, there is a solution in the sense that we showed we can solve the equations of motion for all time. We can solve the hermeticity conditions for all time. And we can solve the canonical commutation relations for one time. What we still need to show is that if they are true at one time, they are true at all times. That's relatively straightforward. But then we still need to ensure that the whole thing is covariant in a general relativistic sense, which means so far we've worked in one coordinate system. And we can show using Darboux that there is a solution such that the canonical commutation relations are holding at one point in time. And then we can also show that if so, they hold at all points in time. But what if we redefine what we mean by time? What if we choose a different coordinate system in which the hypersurfaces of equal time are different hypersurfaces? How do we know that the same solution is also a solution for this new coordinate system? We need to check that we indeed didn't violate general covariance by quantizing the way we do. So we will do that. And then after we've done that, we will check, well, we found a solution. Is it unique? And we will find that it's not. And that will be an opportunity and a problem. We will see. OK, so let's see. Let me remind you that a free Klein-Gordon field in a generic curved space-time must obey the hermeticity conditions, the equations of motion. And the equations of motion can be written in the form of two equations. One is the Klein-Gordon equation for phi. And the other is the equation of motion that relates pi to phi. So pi is not just phi dot, but it also has space derivatives in there. And then the third condition is that on all space-like hypersurfaces, the canonical commutation relations must hold. And it's not obvious that this requirement is even general relativistically covariant. It's just what we do because we don't know any better from special relativity. As it will turn out, this is, in fact, general relativistically covariant. but it's non-trivial to see that this is the case. So how did we go about solving the quantum field theory? We wrote the solution in a form that resembles the solution in special relativity, except that we allowed the so-called mode functions to be any solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, not just the one for Minkowski space. So our ansatz is to say, maybe we can find a solution to this problem by making this ansatz where phi is a linear combination of solutions, complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, times the A and the A dagger operators, where they obey the usual commutation relations. Notice this curious fact that we need here complex valued solutions to the canonical commutation relations, even though the Klein-Gordon equation is a real valued one that we quantized. Okay, so what we showed so far is that the Hermiticity condition is automatically obeyed. Just take the Hermitian conjugate of this and you get itself back again. And we also showed that the equations of motion are obeyed. That's by assumption. We assume that these UK functions are each a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, so therefore the linear combinations are. And the fact that we multiply these solutions with A and A dagger doesn't change the fact that this thing is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, because A and A dagger don't contain space or time derivatives. They are just dragged along as spectators. And also notice that the Klein-Gordon equation has real valued coefficients, which means that if U is a solution, a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then U star, the complex conjugate, is also a solution. Okay, so we showed that the Hermiticity conditions and the equations of motions are obeyed at all time, and we showed that using Darboux's theorem, there's a guarantee that in a fixed coordinate system, the canonical commutation relations can be obeyed at all times, can be obeyed at one time, point in time, if we find, and the Darboux theorem is guaranteeing that, if we find a set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that obeys this equation. It's complicated, but it's really just expressing the canonical commutation relations, right? You plug that ansatz into the canonical commutation relations and you get this condition. Something important that we can read off, and that we did read off from that finding, is that we will not get away with just a finite linear combination of classical solutions here, because if we chose a finite linear combination here of these solutions, if this sum runs only over a finite number of indices, then that equation cannot hold, because the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation are well-behaved functions. And on the right-hand side, we have a distribution, the Dirac delta. So that already ensures that we will need infinitely many of these terms here in order to obey that equation. Also, I wrote the ansatz here with a sum or a series. But of course, you can also do it with a continuous index. But you can't do it with just finitely many index values. OK, so what we need is that this is true for all times, and more than that, it need to be true not only at all times, but also in all coordinate systems at all times. Now, using Darboux's theorem, we showed that there exists a set of solutions U such that such an ansatz actually succeeds and obeys that condition at one point in time. Now, does that mean that the canonical commutation relations are obeyed at all times? Well, there is no freedom in this. The answer is either yes or no. And that's because the equations of motion evolve the field phi and the field pi forward in time. And the equations of motion, therefore, already determine what the canonical commutation relations are going to be later on and whether they are going to be preserved. And the answer is yes, of course, they're going to be preserved. And while we could show that using the theory of partial differential equations, where we would recognize that this is a so-called Wronskian expression that you may have encountered if you studied differential equations, We can also see this on much more general, more abstract grounds. And that's because in quantum theory, any kind of commutation relation, if fulfilled at one time, is fulfilled at all times. And here's how this goes. The canonical commutation relations are fulfilled at all times if they're fulfilled at one time. And that's implied by the self-adjointness of the Hamiltonian. See, even if a Hamiltonian is time-dependent, it always generates a unitary. So the unitary time evolution operator is given by the time-ordered exponential of this expression here. And that operator is unitary. So U dagger is U inverse. Using the time evolution operator, since we are in the Heisenberg picture, we can express the field at late time in terms of the field at the initial time, you know, the time where we've checked that the canonical commutation relations are true. We can express phi in terms of phi at the initial time using the time evolution operator left and right, Heisenberg picture. And the same is true for the canonically conjugate momentum field. It too evolves according to the time evolution operator. And that means that we can write down the canonical commutation relations at the late time t in terms of phi and pi at the early time t naught, simply time evolving the phi and the pi operator. Now notice that when we write out what that commutator really is, it's the product of this times that minus the product the other way around. Now let's look at the product of this times that. Well, you see there's a u dagger, there's a u hat inverse multiplying a u hat. That's just those two annihilate each other. And if we do it the other way around, the other term in the commutator, same story. There's a u inverse and a u that annihilate each other. So therefore, we can write that commutator also in this way, where we have just the inner commutator and we have a u inverse and a u outside the commutator bracket. But the commutator bracket is just the Dirac delta, I h bar times the Dirac delta. So therefore, we get time evolution operators left and right, and in the middle, I h bar Dirac delta. But the Dirac delta is not an operator. It's just a function or distribution. So it commutes with the time evolution operator. And so this one annihilates with that, and we just have this. So the canonical commutation relations are fulfilled. And the same calculation could be done no matter what the canonical commutation relations are. Okay, so we've upgraded our finding. We only knew that we can solve the canonical commutation relations at one point in time. Now we know if so, then the equations of motion take care in the sense that the commutation relations will be obeyed at all times. But that was all in one coordinate system. What if we decide to choose a different coordinate system? And that means a different definition of equal time. The time slices of equal time, the space-like hypersurfaces of equal time could be different. So what if we change coordinate systems such that a time slice, so a spatial hypersurface at a fixed point in time, is changed and becomes a new one? So instead of having a time slice sigma, we now might have a time slice sigma prime. Then we have to go back to how we started solving this using Dabou's theorem. And remember how we did that. We introduced a symplectic form motivated by the form of this Wronskian expression here that comes from the canonical commutation relations. Motivated by that, we introduced this expression here, which we can evaluate at every space-like hypersurface. And it was just right to allow us then to deduce from the Dabou's theorem that we can solve the problem at hand, namely this one. And the way we did is that we said this is a symplectic form where you can plug in two real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, f and h, and you get out a number. And it's anti-symmetric. And because it is symplectic in this way, Dabou's theorem applies. And then we combined the real-valued solutions into complex-valued solutions The symplectic form became an indefinite inner product. I will review that in a sec. And from that, we were able to write down a resolution of the identity in the space of solutions. And that resolution of the identity was this equation. So we solved it in this way. But now, let us question the covariance of this. What if we change coordinate system, and therefore what we mean by equal time? So for that purpose, we give a name to the integrand. Let's call the integrand here J tilde. Now, what is J tilde? Remember here, this is a space-like hypersurface. This is one point in time all over space. And as such, it is three-dimensional. So therefore, that expression is a three-form. So we're going to do a few minutes of differential geometry now. There's not that much differential geometry in this course, but a little bit now. Those of you who took my GR course last term should be very familiar with that sort of thing. Okay, so this is a three-form, and we call it J tilde. And what is the structure of this differential three-form? Well, let's consider this vector here. That's a contravariant vector, right? We have a scalar, and then we have a differentiated scalar, and that gives us a covariant vector field. But then we raise the index with the metric, so we get a contravariant vector field. This is a contravariant vector field, the J mu. Now, remember the so-called volume form. It's a four form. And if we plug in a vector field, a tangent vector field like this, then what's left over is a three form. And that three form is our J tilde here, right? You see that? And the square root of G comes from the volume form. So the J tilde is what you get when you take the inner derivation, you plug that vector field into the volume form. That's what this canonical commutation relation left-hand side is, differential geometrically speaking. And now what we need to show is this. We need to show that this symplectic form gives us the same value for the same solutions F and H, even if we choose a different coordinate system in which we have a different notion of time going on. So let's say this was an integral over a space-like hypersurface at a particular point in time throughout space. Now imagine that this is, roughly speaking, time. Time is going to the right and space is going upwards. So I'm just drawing one space coordinate, but multiple time, one time coordinate to the right. Then in one coordinate system, let's say the one in which we started, equal time meant this space-like hypersurface here, just symbolically indicated like that. So this is the set of all events of equal time in the first coordinate system. But then we can slice space-time also, we can foliate it differently, such that asymptotically it's the same time, but we allow that at finite distances, you know, it's a different slicing of space-time. And then it's a set of other events that have equal time according to this new slicing, this new foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. And this new slicing we might call sigma prime. So what we want to show is that if we calculate for given solutions F and H, if we calculate that in one coordinate system using a space-like hypersurface sigma, or we try to calculate it instead by integrating in this other coordinate system, again over equal time, but that means over a different space-like hypersurface, then we get the exact same number out of it. We want to show that that's invariant. The way we prove that this is the case is that we integrate over both sigma and sigma prime. So we take that integral here, and we integrate the whole thing over sigma and sigma prime. Okay, and when we do that, when we write down the total integral here, then we are calculating the integral over the surface of a four-dimensional space-time volume. That's three-dimensional surface that consists of two pieces of a four-dimensional volume. When you do it like this, then the normal vector that goes into the calculation is always pointing outwards. Just to remember that, right? If you calculate, let's say, over the surface of a sphere, then canonically the definition of the integral is such that the normal vector points outwards. Which means the normal vectors point this way, which means counter the time direction, and here in the positive time direction, because this is how time flows. Now that we have an integral over the surface of the three-dimensional surface of a four-dimensional volume, we can invoke Stokes' theorem. And we can say, OK, instead of integrating our j tilde over the boundary by Stokes, we can also instead integrate over the bulk b the exterior derivative of j tilde. The bulk is four-dimensional. And the exterior derivative of a three-form is a four-form, so that matches. So it's a four-form integrated over a four-dimensional volume. So what are we aiming to show? We want to show that integrating over this much, over this space like hypersurface, gives us the same value as integrating over that space like hypersurface. Now, imagine we could show that the right-hand side is zero. For example, because the exterior derivative of j is 0. That is to say that j tilde is a closed form. If the right-hand side is 0, then we are indeed done. And the reason is that we then know that the sum of these two integrals is 0. How does that mean that they're equal? Well, it means they're equal because, you see, here the integration is with the normal direction to the left, and here's to the right. So if we just flip that, then we get the integral here with the normal direction in the proper direction. But we get a minus of that. So a minus of this plus this is equal to 0. So the two are the same, right? So that's what we want to show. So if we can show that the right-hand side is vanishing because j tilde turns out to be a closed differential form, so that the exterior derivative of it is vanishing, then we're done. Because then the integral over the boundary is given by the integral over the first boundary plus the integral over the second boundary. But for the first boundary, we change the direction of the normal, picks up a minus sign. And so we find that the two integrals are the same if we integrate in the same direction, if we choose the same definition of the normal direction. And then if we can show that dj tilde is equal to 0, this means that the evaluation of the symplectic form does not depend on the coordinate system, which is what we want to prove. OK, so now we have to show that the exterior derivative of j tilde is vanishing. Now remember what the exterior derivative of j tilde is. For that, let's first remember what j tilde is. Remember, we take this contravariant vector j, which is just what's in the integrand in here. So this here is a vector j, this one. And then we plug that into the volume form omega. So that's to say we take the inner derivation of omega in the direction of j, and that gives us a three-form j tilde. So that's what we use here. We have that the exterior derivative is therefore the exterior derivative of the inner derivation of the volume form in the direction of j, which is also, if you remember, the exterior derivative of that is the divergence of the vector field j with respect to the volume form omega. And that, if you remember, is this expression. This should look a little familiar. Because imagine you work in Minkowski space and the metric and Cartesian coordinates. And therefore, the metric is just trivially plus 1, minus, minus, minus 1. In that case, the square root of g is just 1. And what we get here is what you would normally call a divergence. You differentiate the first component in the first direction plus the second component in the second direction, etc. This is just a little bit decorated in the case of general relativity. OK, so now we want to show that this is equal to 0. What we need to do, therefore, is evaluate this. So we need to evaluate that derivative of that bracket here. Okay, here's the derivative of that bracket. And at that point, we need to spell out what J really is. J, remember, is all of this. Right? That's this contravariant vector field J. And since we differentiate it by the product rule, we get 8 terms. We get a term where we differentiate this, that, 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 and here again. So we get 8 terms. But we don't have to write it as 8 terms. We can do this a little bit more cleverly. First of all, looking at this, we realize, 2 terms cancel for sure. And that's the term where we apply that derivative, you see, where we apply that derivative on f. By the product rule, there is one term where we apply that derivative on f. Then we get an f comma mu and a d nu h. So that's h comma nu, right? So we get the derivative of f and a derivative of h. And we also get a term where we differentiate h and differentiate f. And those two terms cancel each other out. Now, you might think, wait a moment, the index structure is not right because f is differentiated in the mu direction, h is differentiated in the nu direction, and here the other way around. Not a problem because we are contracting with the metric, which is symmetric. So therefore, those two terms are going to go away. And I spelled that out. So we differentiate here with respect to f, that gives us this term. And we differentiate with respect to the h here, that gives us that term. And those two terms cancel each other out. By the way, just as a writing technique, when you do long calculations and you want to avoid making mistakes, whenever you have a term that cancels another term, then for sure cross them out. But also put a symbol here, like 1 and 1, it means that this term cancels that term. See, if you had a long string of stuff, then in this way you can keep track of which term canceled which term. It's very valuable because you know how it is. You do a long calculation, there's always a few bugs in there, right? And in this way, you can more efficiently track what you did. Of course, in this case, it wouldn't have been necessary. There's only one pair that cancels. But in larger calculations, this can really save a lot of time. OK, and then apart from differentiating f here and h there, we also have to keep f and differentiate the rest. Keep h and differentiate the rest. So these are those terms where we keep f and differentiate the rest, keep h, differentiate the rest. And beautifully, the rest is the D'Alembert operator. It's the wave operator up to square root of g. So what that means is that this expression here is actually minus m squared h square root of g on the grounds of the Klein-Gordon equation holding. Remember that these f and h are not arbitrary functions. They have to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. This is a symplectic form on the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, not in the space of all functions, just the solutions. OK, so that means we get rid of all those derivatives, and we just get mass terms here and there. Let's collect those two terms down here. And what we see is that this is square root of g, and then minus f m squared h plus h m squared f. They cancel each other out. It's equal to 0. And indeed, therefore, yes, things are fine. The 3 form is closed. The exterior derivative of the j tilde vanishes. The right-hand side is 0, so the left-hand side is 0. Therefore, integrating over this space-like hypersurface is the same as integrating over that space-like hypersurface. All of this would look miraculous if we didn't know that what's underlying is a fully covariant theory that we can have a nice, close look at in the Lagrangian formalism with the action. It's just that this is better for quantization. So I think this just works out because it had to. Right? It's not that somebody constructed it very carefully. No, it just had to work out because underlying is a theory of which we know that it is covariant. That's why we did the detour via the Lagrangian and the action. All right, so what we've now finally proved, we finally proved that at least for globally hyperbolic space-times, there always exist mode functions u such that our ansatz for phi and pi not only obeys the Hermiticity conditions and the Klein-Gordon equation and the relationship between pi and phi, but also the canonical commutation relations at all time and in all coordinate systems. So we have full covariance. It doesn't matter in which coordinate system we perform the quantization, the physics is going to be the same. For relaxation, because that was a little heavy, let's just see how all of this plays out in Minkowski space, where we know what everything is. Let's just see how it plays out there. So for Minkowski space, we had found by other methods, not referring to Dabou, we had found that the Klein-Gordon field can be written in this form. And when we write it in this form, we recognize that this is a mode function, and that's its complex conjugate. Actually, this multiplied with all of the stuff that's before. So we can read off that uk of x and t, being this expression, is the mode function that we had found for Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates. We know that the Klein-Gordon equation is fulfilled. So that's easy to check. You just do the second time derivative, second space derivative, and easy to check that this obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. The Hermiticity of this phi hat, that is to show that phi hat is equal to phi hat dagger, is trivial because this Hermitian conjugated gives us that, and vice versa. So that condition is also fulfilled. But let's check the canonical commutation relations now. Now, in Minkowski space, the square root of g factor is just 1. And we have that g 0 nu is Kronecker delta of 0 nu, which means that pi is phi dot, for example. And it also means that the left-hand side of this equation simplifies a lot, because the square root of g is just 1. And that's just the Kronecker delta in 0 nu, which means that here we only have time derivatives and no space derivatives. So what we have is that in Minkowski space, our mode function needs to obey this condition, which becomes that condition. It's just the integral over all of space. Not all of space, all of momentum space, right? And here we have the time derivatives of u star and of u. Let's work all of that out by substituting in what we know the mode function is. We plug it in here, plug it in there, and here we have it. Mode function with this prefactor and mode function complex conjugated with this prefactor. Notice that this I omega k arises from that time derivative of the uk star. Right? We have to time differentiate this. This is the uk star. So we get an I omega k down. And here we time differentiate the uk. And the uk is this, and the time derivative gets us down a minus I omega k. Now that comes with a minus sign, it's inherited from here, and there's another minus sign, so actually this term is equal to that term. It gives us an I omega k here and an I omega k there. And what we then obtain is that this 2i omega k divided by 2 omega k just leaves us with an I. And we are left with this integral over here, where this all goes away. And that integral is just a Dirac delta in positions, in the three positions. And therefore, it all works out. But we also notice, again, that it would not have sufficed to use only a finite number of these solutions here. So if we had truncated this, That would not have worked out because it wouldn't have given us a Dirac delta. It would have given us a softened Dirac delta. It would have given us a sinc function if we hadn't run the integral over all values of k. Okay, summary so far. To solve the quantum field theory of a free Klein-Gordon field on a curved space-time involves hermeticity conditions, equations of motions, and the canonical commutation relations. We made this ansatz here. We realized we need to at least infinitely many of these terms. And we showed that at least if the space-time is globally hyperbolic, there exists such a solution. And it solves all of the three conditions at all times in all coordinate systems. That sounds good, but how many such solutions exist? And it's more than one. It's in fact infinitely many. There exist actually many such sets of solutions. By a set of solutions, I mean solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, complex valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, UK, that we assemble in this ansatz in order to get a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation problem in quantum field theory. But it turns out that just because we can find one set of functions U doesn't mean we can't find another one. There could be another set that we might call the UK bar and UK double bar and UK triple bar and so on. In fact, we can write down infinitely many of them. How can we see this non-uniqueness? Well, for that, let's go back to the basics. We looked at the condition to solve the canonical commutation relations, and we found that this symplectic form arises there. And then we invoked Damu's theorem that says that because that thing is antisymmetric, there exists a basis in the space of functions such that in that basis, not only can every function be expressed just in terms of its linear combination coefficients in that basis, but also the symplectic form can take then this very simple form here. So if we choose a so-called Dabou basis in the space of solutions, in the space of real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then in that basis, the inner product, no, not the inner product, the symplectic product of two functions f and h is given by this matrix, where we have these 2x2 blocks with entry 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And then from such a Dabou basis, by defining complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, I mean by always combining two of these solutions together, you know, the one, this is always mixing two of the solutions, right? And we take those two solutions and real valued ones, and we define a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation from that. And then these un were actually allowed us to write down a resolution of the identity in the space of functions here, and that resolution of the identity was the Wronskian condition. So the uns provide us with a solution. But let's assume we found a Dabou basis. Could there be other Dabou bases? And that's the issue. Yes, there are. This is quite different from the spectral theorem that we have for unitary and self-adjoint operators. There, the basis is unique. Up to normalization, the basis vectors are unique. I mean, up to phase prefactors, for example. But Dabou bases are not unique at all. For example, let's just look at one little square in there. Even in there, it's not unique. So let's assume that, for example, V1 and V2 are Dabou bases of a two-dimensional symplectic space. Then, so in that basis, we have that the symplectic product can be written using this matrix. Then we can ask, can we find linear transformations that map V1 and V2 into new vectors, V1 bar and V2 bar in a linear fashion? We write it like this, Vi is equal to Q Vi bar, or with an inverse, the other way around, in such a way that the symplectic product is preserved. This is the analogous question to what we do, for example, in special relativity, where we ask, what kind of coordinate transformations can we do on the position and time coordinates such that before or after the transformation, the metric, that is to say, the invariant length, is preserved? And the answer to that question is, Lorentz transformations. You can perform Lorentz transformations, they preserve the metric. Here, this is what we want to preserve. And we can ask, okay, so what linear transformations preserve that? And it turns out there are plenty. So you see, we have here the inner product in terms of V, and then we express V in terms of the V bars, but there's a Q then. So we can write here a V, and here we write a V bar, and here V bar, transpose, and here the V, and the same inner product, right? Same story as for the Lorentz transformations. And if you work that out, you find, yes, there are linear transformations that will preserve this. And these are all those linear transformations Q, for which it is true that their matrix elements A, B, C, D obey that condition. You may recognize it. It's the condition for the determinant of Q to be 1. The set of all matrices, all 2 by 2 matrices that obey this, is the set of all 2 by 2 matrices of determinant 1. Right? AD minus BC. Which means that you can take any invertible matrix and normalize it, and then it will qualify for that. The story is actually even that there's even much more freedom in the Dabu, in the choice of Dabu bases, because not only can you mix the first and the second basis vectors in this way using a matrix Q, but you can also mix basis vectors from any one of these cube, from any one of these squares there. And if you arrange the coefficients right, you still have that the symplectic product is preserved. Now remember that the symplectic product is for the real valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And what we then do is we take two of them together, two solutions, to get us a complex valued solution. And these are the U functions. These are the actual mode functions. So this non-uniqueness here also shows up as non-uniqueness of the mode functions. And let me spell out a little exercise for you. It's analogous to this, but it's the full deal for the complex valued functions. Remember what happens when you take the symplectic inner product for the real valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and then define the mode functions as linear combinations of a pair of real-valued solutions. Here, these ones. What happens is that in terms of the un, this symplectic inner product becomes an indefinite inner product. So it's just like a Hilbert space inner product, but it's indefinite. It can also have lengths that are negative. Namely, we find that the uns with the ums have a Kronecker delta, the un stars with the um stars have a minus Kronecker delta, and the inner product between the uns and the um stars is always zero. We use that to, to write down a resolution of the identity in terms of these mode functions, and that in the basis becomes the Wronskian condition for the conservation of the commutation relations. So now let's again ask, is this unique? If we have a set of UNs, of complex valued solutions to the Clairaut equation, that obey these conditions, which is the equivalent to obeying the anti-symmetry here, then is that unique? Or can we find new U-bar functions that could do the job just as well? And the answer is yes. So let's consider new mode functions made out of the old mode functions by linear combination. So let's say the new mode functions, U and bar, are some linear combination of the old UMs and the old UM stars with some matrices of coefficients A and B. Clearly, we cannot just choose for A and B whatever we want. If we choose whatever we want, there is no reason that this indefinite inner product goes into the same indefinite inner product. But what you can work out on paper, and I suggest you do that, is assume this, make these ansatz, and then find out what conditions you have to place on the matrices A and B such that the new mode functions still obey the same inner product relations. And the answer, I'm giving you the answer so that you can verify that you did the calculation right. The answer is that these matrices A and B have to obey these conditions, like A dagger A minus B transpose B star equal to the identity matrix. And as long as the matrices A and B are chosen to obey these conditions, and there are plenty of solutions to that, then we will find from one set of solutions, one set of mode functions, a new set of mode functions that is just as good because it obeys the same conditions there. We could have started with the other one as well. There is a complete democracy among them. Are there any questions so far? It looks like we got more than we bargained for. Wouldn't we have been happy if we had just a uniqueness theorem and it says, yes, the solution exists, it's good for all times in all coordinate systems, and that's it, there is one solution. But what we see here is that, no, we get any number of solutions. If we have one set of mode functions, we can generate any number of other sets of mode functions that work just as well. So for example, we start with one set of mode functions that we may call U, and its complex conjugate U star. And then this phi will solve the Clairaut equation, Hermeticity condition, and then we can also calculate the pi from it, and everything is fine. Canonical commutation relations hold at all time and in every coordinate system. But then we can use matrices A and B like this that obey these conditions. And then when we use those matrices, we can define new mode functions U bar. And then we can write down as if we can start solving the problem again from scratch as if that had never happened. And we can now write down our field in this way, where we have the new mode functions multiplying what we should call new A and A dagger operators. They still obey the same commutation relations, but there's no reason to think that they would be the same as those. So we give them the name AK bar and AK bar dagger. And we could go on, and we could write down an infinite number of representations for our field phi hat that are all equally valid. And it's a bit worrying because if we choose one of those, for example, the first approach, then we know that because of the commutation relations of the A and A dagger, there is a vector in the Hilbert space representation of this A and A dagger, there is a vector that's annihilated by A. by all of the A's. And that vector we might call the vector zero here. We shouldn't call it the vacuum. No reason to think that it is the vacuum vector, especially because there's going to be many of those. So there's one vector that we may call zero, which is annihilated by all of those AKs. And then we know from experience that if we apply A dagger operators on this zero operator here, then we get vectors that we might call the NK vectors. And together, we know that they span the Hilbert space. Essentially, because they are the eigenbases of a self-adjoint operator. Do you know which one? These guys are the eigenbases of the self-adjoint operator A dagger A, right? The number operator. And so, yeah, so we get a Hilbert basis. We get a basis of orthonormal vectors in the Hilbert space. But we get another basis if we choose the other approach to solving the quantum field theory. And a different vector 0 bar is annihilated by these different vectors A bar. And we get these enumerated basis vectors that, again, span a Hilbert space. So then the fundamental question arises, just a sec, the fundamental question arises then, is this different physics? Or is it still the same physics, perhaps in a different basis? You?
Can you actually prove that the like a zero vector and the zero bar vectors are different?
Yes, we will see that how they relate to each other. I mean, you can also just, you know, use this linear, this expression here, and then see, you know, it's very similar to the calculation that we did for the externally driven harmonic oscillator, right? It's very similar. Okay, so the big question is, are these solutions to the quantum field theory in curved space-time, are they describing different physics? Or do they differ merely by a change of basis? So it could also be that this is exactly the same physics, just described differently. A bit like choosing a different coordinate system. In quantum mechanics, it's choosing a different basis. And the answer is subtle. It depends. It could be different physics. Even though there are some caveats there, it generally isn't different physics, but it could in principle be. And just for completeness, and because some of you might be interested in actually pushing this theory further, let me tell you all the caveats and subtleties that are connected with this.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. So, if you speak about the observables of the theory, all the things that you can really measure as an experimentalist,
yeah,
is the field enough, or we need to other objects? Is the field the only mathematical object that you need to have all those?
You need the field and the canonically conjugate field. The field and the canonical conjugate field together span all of the observables. They span the algebra of everything that you might ever want to observe.
So if they don't change from the experimentalist point of view, couldn't say that it's the same physics? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's what we are trying to address here, right? Whether there is genuinely new physics, so different predictions for the same observables, or whether it's going to be the same predictions for the same observables. See, in the second case, where it's not different physics, where it's just different choice of bases, the predictions for observables will be the same. Because an observable is never a vector, is never an operator. It's always a scalar product. And as such, independent of the choice of bases. OK, so let's assume first that we can impose an infrared and an ultraviolet cutoff with negligible consequences. It's not quite true. There's some subtler things, right? If you take, for example, your infrared cutoff and you make it too small, then you might feel here what, I mean, your description of nature might be impacted by what you choose for the boundary conditions of that box, if the box is too small. But if you make it huge, the general assumption is that it doesn't matter what boundary conditions you choose there. But if you do choose an infrared cutoff and an ultraviolet cutoff, then it means that we have truncated our quantum field theory to the extent that we actually only have a finite number of these ANA Dago operators, a finite number of the phi k and the pi k. You see, if we put an infrared cutoff, then we discretize momentum space, or the generalized version of momentum space. Like, the analog of the momentum space might be the eigenspace of the Laplace operator as far as space is concerned. So you discretize, you can generally discretize if you compactify your space by putting things in a box, even in curved space-time. So you've discretized it. And then if you also apply an ultraviolet cutoff, it means you're not even considering all of them. You're not even going to arbitrarily small wavelengths in there. And that means you have only a finite number of degrees of freedom. But if you have only a finite number of degrees of freedom, and by that I mean the analog of position and momentum pairs, like phi and pi pairs, if you have only a finite number of them, then the Stone von Neumann theorem applies. And what it says is that if you have pairs of non-commuting observables, like x and p, xi and pj, or xi and pi, or phi k and pi k, if you have only a finite number of them, and on the same Hilbert space, you have another same finite number of these pairs that obey these commutation relations, then actually they can be mapped into each other. Then one representation of these non-commuting observables is equivalent to another one because it's just a change of basis in the Hilbert space. Which means that the new x tilde and p tilde are always obtained by a unitary from the old x tilde, from the old x and p operators. And the same is true for fields if you have only a finite number of degrees of freedom there. Now, there is a subtlety to this, which is that while it is often stated as I'm stating it here, the Stone and von Neumann theorem, that's not what Stone and von Neumann really proved. They didn't prove that all representations of the canonical commutation relations are unitarily equivalent, which is the claim here. They didn't prove that. What they did prove is this. If you exponentiate the position operators and you exponentiate the momentum operators, then you get unitary operators. And these unitary operators obey also commutation relations. Of course, not these, but the exponentiated version of those, right? Which is basically that this times that minus a phase times this the other way around is equal to 1. And what they showed is that if, as long as you have finitely many of those, the representation is unique of those. They're all unitarily equivalent. So there is a subtle difference between showing that these canonical commutation relations are uniquely represented on a Hilbert space up to unitary changes of bases and saying the same for these. And the reason is that these x and p operators are unbounded operators. They can't be defined on the entire Hilbert space. I don't know if you know that, but unbounded operators, those with an unbounded spectrum, cannot be represented on the entire Hilbert space. They are always only defined on a dense subset of the Hilbert space. But once you exponentiate them and you get unitaries, well, unitaries have the entire spectrum on the unit circle in the complex plane, so they are all bounded operators. They all live on the entire Hilbert space, and that's where you can prove it. And there are some subtle, believed to be pathological cases where here it doesn't work, but here it does work. I do not think that there's physics in this difference, but I thought I'd tell you about it so that you don't believe that Stone and von Neumann really proved this, they proved that.
Mm-hmm. Usually the Stone von Neumann theorem is stated with reducibility and whatnot, but...
With what?
Like the reducibility or irreducibility of the...
Yes, you need the representation to be irreducible because you could always tag on some other Hilbert spaces. And then, of course, you have an isometry, but not a unitary. That
so does that mean if you have, if you try to quantize and you have a reducible representation, your theory is pathological?
Again, if what?
If the representation is reducible.
No, that doesn't make it pathological. It just means that they are two different representations are equivalent up to an isometry, and you know, isometry is a map that maps inner product preservingly from Hilbert space to Hilbert space, but maybe not the entire Hilbert space into the entire Hilbert space, but there might be some deficiency space there. It's not exactly like that. You have a tensor product there, a tensor factor, so you have basically other systems in there. Yeah, so that's not the subtlety. The subtlety arises really between the unbounded ones and the bounded ones here. It's surprisingly hard to find literature on the difference between the two, but it's good to know that in case you ever run into something like this, that there is a subtle difference. Okay, so now if we apply this to quantum mechanics, and we can also apply it to ultraviolet and infrared regularized quantum field theory, then what this says is that if we write our position operators as A and A dagger operators, and position operators and other position operators that obey the same commutation relations, just like we had up here, but I'm writing it in the X and the P's because it's perhaps more intuitive, but they could just as well be phi's and pi's, phi and pi fields, then what the Stone and von Neumann theorem says is that the A are obtained from the A bar by a unitary transformation. One of them needs to be daggered, by the way. Sorry about that. Where the U is unitary. And what that means is that these A and A daggers are the same as these A and A daggers, or the same as these A and A daggers, up to a change of bases. Except for a change of bases, they're the same. And therefore, you know, this is the same as that, is the same as that, and so on, up to a change of bases in the Hilbert space. Now, that's if we can truncate to a infrared ultraviolet cutoff theory without consequences. But now let's consider the possibility that we cannot or do not want to truncate the quantum field theory with an infrared and an ultraviolet cutoff, so that we are left with still an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Infinitely many of these x tildes and p tildes, etc., and infinitely many of the phi and the pi's and the a's and the a daggers and so on. In that case, Stone von Neumann theorem doesn't apply. Now, when could that happen? In principle, that sort of thing can happen, and therefore we have unitarily non-equivalent solutions that differ by more than just a change of basis, and we would have what we might call different phases. It's like in a phase transition. In fact, phase transitions, strictly speaking, in condensed matter physics, always require that you take the so-called thermodynamic limit, where you make the system infinitely large. Now, this is where it becomes subtle, because you can take a superconductor in your hand, and it will be behaving superconductingly. I mean, maybe it's too cold for you to hold in with some protection, right? But the superconductor is not going to be infinitely large. And what that means is that when you look at the phase transition, for example, let's say the conductivity as a function of the temperature, then according to the clean theory, where you've taken the thermodynamic limit of the superconductor being infinitely large, what you have is that the conductivity drops to zero, the resistivity drops to zero, and the resistivity stays zero as the temperature is further lowered below the transition temperature. This is a function that cannot be analytic, right? It's a function that goes from a finite value to zero, and then it stays zero. You can never have that in finite dimensions. Linear algebra can never lead to this. Because with linear algebra and anything that comes from it, with normal analytic algebraic functions, you will not have that behavior. Because if it was an analytic function, remember, if you know an analytic function on a small interval, you know it everywhere. Because an analytic function is defined as one that has a Taylor expansion with infinite radius of convergence. So you can Taylor expand it around a little area, and then you know it everywhere. So if the function is zero on an interval, then it's zero everywhere. Analytic function is zero everywhere. So you really need, in order to have a clean phase transition where something drops to zero and stays zero, in order to have that, you must have an infinite system so that you have the ability to actually get functions that are non-analytic. Just like here, you know, where we had this Wronskian condition where we need infinitely many mode functions that are each well-behaved, have to collaborate to produce a distribution, a Dirac delta distribution on the right-hand side. Right, and so what I wanted to say is that the thermodynamic limit is the limit of having infinitely large crystal, etc. But you can have a superconductor that is as small as a grain of salt. It's not really infinitely large. However, it's almost infinitely large if you consider how many particles it has, how many atoms it has, this little crystal, right? It's very large. But if you look at its superconducting transition temperature, yeah, it's going to be smooth. It's not going to have, you know, this non-analytic behavior. And for quantum field theory, it's a similar thing. You know, you might have some behavior that is much easier to grasp mathematically if you take the infinite size limit. Like for the crystal, if you calculate phase transitions, it's a cleaner thing to say, oh, there's a fixed transition temperature, and below that, the conductivity is infinite, the resistivity is zero, right? And that's a risk that we, in principle, encounter when we do quantum field theory, and we just willy-nilly introduce infrared cutoffs, right? We might, it might always be justified. It probably is. It's always justified to put an infrared cutoff, at least as long as we're interested in local physics. But we might miss something interesting by putting an infrared cutoff, because if we don't have it, then we might see some non-analytic behavior, some non-equivalent representations, right? So I don't want to dismiss the possibility that there is interesting physics happening there. It won't actually be a non-equivalence of representations, but for practical purposes, it will look like that. Just like a little crystal of high-temperature superconductor. It doesn't have a sharp phase transition, but for practical purposes, it does. Anyway, so let's consider now the possibility that we cannot truncate to, or that we don't want to truncate to a finite number of degrees of freedom. Now, when would that happen? For example, for phase transitions, systems with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And in this case, the quantum field theory can indeed have unitarily non-equivalent representations. And so we could have different physics. Now, what's the physics underlying that? Why does really something happen when you go to infinitely many degrees of freedom? And the intuition there is this. Imagine you have a vector A, and you have a vector B, and then a vector C. You see, A and C are orthogonal to each other. But B has a component in A, and it has a component in C. So in particular, you could, for example, take linear combinations of C and B to produce A. Right? You can do that because, you know, you just Yeah, I mean, this thing has a component of that in it. So you just take that piece out of it, that it points in this direction, right? So this vector minus the C vector gives us the A vector, or a multiple of it. But the thing is this. Imagine here you have that A and B, the inner product of A and B is some number alpha, which is not zero, right? So A and B have a non-zero inner product, so they have some finite angle in between them. Let's say that's the situation, where alpha is a number between 1 and 0. So A and B are not orthogonal. But now imagine you have a lot of copies of your systems, right? So this could be a qubit or something, or whatever system. But in any case, you have a lot of copies of it, like many harmonic oscillators in the quantum field, for example, too. But in any case, just abstractly, for one system, you might have that it has a state A, it has a state B, and they are not orthogonal. But now you have many copies of these systems. And let's say you have a state where you have all of the copies of the system are in the state A. And you have another state where all of the copies of the system are in state B. Now, what's the overlap between them? Now, the overlap is calculated pairwise, right? This A with that, this this Brier A with this ket B, this Brier A with that ket B, etc. And what you get is that the overlap is now alpha to the power n, which means that these vectors get actually, they become more orthogonal. Isn't that weird, right? So this vector is more orthogonal than, I mean, these two vectors, this AAAA vector is more orthogonal, has a larger angle with the vector BBBB than the A and the B have to each other, just because this number alpha gets smaller, exponentially smaller, in fact, right? Because if alpha is between 0 and 1, alpha to the power n is way smaller than 1. And now that's all fine. It's still true that if the B is, let's say, this vector, so it's almost orthogonal to A, right? Then you can still linearly combine from C and B, the vector A, because B still has a component in this direction. But if you keep pushing this and you have more and more systems together, and so you have that this inner product here grows and grows, and then the value goes to zero, and for infinitely many, it is zero. And you see that this is a complete difference now, because the moment B is orthogonal to A, it's useless for trying to produce the vector A. It has nothing of it anymore, nothing. And that's the difference between a thermodynamic limit and not thermodynamic limit, between having infinitely many copies of a system or finitely many. As I said, I don't think that it's actually different physics. Just like superconductivity doesn't actually need that we have infinitely large systems. But we would miss something if we didn't take that into account. It's sort of a warning sign or a hint that if that sort of mathematics occurs, we might be seeing something that looks like a phase transition. And then once we have it, we can consider it also for the finite system. But we might miss it. We might not expect it if we don't look at the infinite case as well. OK, so from now on, we will assume that we are not going to encounter subtleties like this. I don't want to exclude them, but we can only do so much in this course. And in cosmology, I don't think, at least I don't know of any work that has picked up on the possibility that we might be doing something wrong by quantizing the Klein-Gordon field without taking this into account. So we will not pursue this any further now, and we will assume that we can implement infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs willy-nilly as we want and need. And therefore, we will apply the Stone and von Neumann theorem to conclude that when we solve the Klein-Gordon equation, using some mode functions or other mode functions or yet other mode functions, then we always write down actually the same field phi, just in a different representation, differing by a choice of bases. Okay, so we will assume that we can put the infrared ultraviolet cutoffs, and therefore the phi can be written this way or that way or that way. We can generate Fock bases as we want. We can generate the Fock bases with the A and A dagger, with the A bars and A bar dagger, and any other choices as well. And they're all equally good. They all describe the same field phi. And then from phi, we can calculate the pi. We can calculate any observables we want. And as long as Stone-Fort-Neumann holds, all the physical predictions will come out the same no matter what. However, in practice, it would work like this. We choose, for example, this UK mode functions, just some of one of the choices. And then we get this zero vector that is annihilated by the A operators. And then we build this Fock basis on the Hilbert space. Here are the basis vectors, and we know they span the Hilbert space. And then we might say, okay, but on Tuesdays I use these. And I have a zero vector that has a bar on it, and it's annihilated by all the A bar operators. And using the A dagger, we can build a whole Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space that way. And of course, the nagging question is, does the choice of mode functions matter? In principle, of course not, because Stone-Fort-Neumann, it's just two different representations of the same fields. So no, it does not matter. In practice, however, it can matter. And why does it matter in practice? It's because it can be so useful. If whenever we identify, whenever we know which vector is the vacuum state, if we know which one it is, let's say we find out psi, by some means we find out there is a vector in Hilbert space, it's the vacuum state, and we can somehow pin down which vector it is. In that case, it would be very desirable to choose our mode functions in such a way that the corresponding vector zero is this one. Right? That would be cool. Because then we can immediately also identify what the one particle states are, the two particle states are, and so on. In principle, if we don't care about the vacuum state, doesn't matter, right? But if we care about what is the vacuum state and what are the particle states, then it's just a matter of very high convenience to choose the mode function in such a way, to choose the mode functions in such a way that the corresponding zero operator, the one that's annihilated by the A operators, happens to be what we know to be the vacuum state. Now notice that we have not yet considered how we might actually identify which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state. That will occupy us for a little while to find out how can we actually identify which state that is. But once we know which state that is in the Hilbert space, we may want to choose the mode function such that that state is this one. Now, so what we are going to do is this. Just a bit of an outlook. Let's say we know that the system state is the vacuum state initially, and it's psi, and by some clever considerations, we figured out which state that is in the Hilbert space. Then we choose mode functions appropriately so that this state is this one. And we do that at the initial time. Before anything happens, let's say before a black hole forms, or before the universe undergoes a period of rapid expansion, inflation, and things like that. So we do that right away. And because we do it at the initial time, we write here in. And this is, by the way, also the initial state, right? So we might call this also initial state. Now remember that we work in the Heisenberg picture. So even 13.8 billion years later, the state of the system is still this one, because the states don't change, right? It's that state in the Hilbert space that is forever going to be the state. But we can ask, like 13.8 billion years later, what is the vacuum state now? There's no reason to think that the vacuum state is still the same state. And the same issue with black hole formation. Before a black hole forms, we could ask, what's the vacuum state? We find out, aha, it's this state in the Hilbert space. And then we choose our mode function such that this zero vector is this one. And it will be that vector even after a black hole might have formed. But after the black hole has formed, we can again ask the question, what state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state? And then we identify that it might be a different vector. Or, and that's the case that we will address initially, in cosmology, right? So before a period of rapid expansion, we identify this is the vacuum state. We choose our mode functions such that the corresponding vector zero is that vector. And that's always going to be the state of the system. But what is the vacuum then? And the answer might be it's a vector that we might call like this. Right? I'm not saying that the state of the universe is that it is in that vector, that it's described by this state. I'm just saying that if at that point we want to identify what would be the vacuum state, then it's a particular vector, right? A five-particle state would also be some vector, but the no-particle state would also be some vector. And let's call it phi. And that phi is generally not equal to the vector psi. And what that means is particle creation. Right? It means particle creation because we know that the system is in this state. Heisenberg picture couldn't change, right? So we know the system is in this state. But we know that later on, the no particle state is that one, which is a different state. So what used to be the vacuum state, what still is the state of the system, is no longer the no particle state. It has to be a multiparticle state. So that's how in the Heisenberg picture we figure out that particle creation happened. In fact, what we'll be mostly after is not so much particle creation. There is particle creation also in the expanding universe. But that's not a big effect. It's actually a very tiny effect. But what we are after is, of course, any kind of excitation, any going beyond the vacuum. And that will be fluctuations that can be better described as fluctuations of the field character, not the particle character. Because as we will see in quantum field theory and curved space-time, the particle picture itself reaches its limitations of validity. We cannot always say, oh, we have this many particles, we have that many particles. It just doesn't make any sense anymore. And remember, I alluded to it earlier, why that is. It's because the mode oscillators can actually flip. And while the mode oscillators are regular harmonic oscillators, they have an equidistant energy spectrum. And the higher the mode oscillator is excited, let's say the mode oscillator for momentum k is excited fivefold, then it means you have five particles of momentum k. But if the same mode oscillator is like this way down, the spectrum is no longer discrete. It's a continuous spectrum downwards. And you can't, there is no particle picture. There just is no concept of particle in that circumstance. But the main point is that what starts out as the vacuum state is later no longer the vacuum state. And the Heisenberg picture, I know we are just, I'm just emphasizing these things because we are usually trained to think of the states evolving. But here the state is frozen. It's the observables that change. And in particular, for example, what is the ground state of the Hamiltonian can change, right? Over time, so the vacuum state can change. Right, and so in this way we can describe particle production due to cosmic expansion, and we will also be able to describe the generating of quantum fluctuations and the amplification of quantum fluctuations in this way. So the key message here is that usually when we are faced with this abundance of choice because of the Stone von Neumann theorem, namely that we can write the quantum field in terms of such mode functions and their AA dagger and other mode functions and their ANA dagger and yet other mode functions, etc., infinite choices. What usually ends up happening in practice is this. We have some interesting evolution occurring, like a black hole forming or the universe undergoing rapid expansion for a while. And then we say, OK, let's focus on the period before and the period after. Just like in the externally driven harmonic oscillator that we did, remember? We are not so interested in the moment of driving because things are complicated there, but before and after. And so we make one choice here of these mode functions to describe the before situation and another choice of mode functions to describe the after situation. Not that we have to. We could describe everything in just one with one choice, but it's convenient because before all the driving happens, if we play our cards right, if we choose the right mode functions, we can conveniently describe the no particle state as the state annihilated by those A. And if after all the action has happened, we play our cards right, we can choose mode functions such that what is the vacuum state then is the state annihilated by those guys, for example. And then what we have in order to calculate what happened from before to after is just a unitary transformation, the Bogoliubov transformation, from this choice to that choice, for example. Just in the same way as we did for the externally driven harmonic oscillator, just a bit more complicated, but in spirit very similar. And we can calculate then, for example, what used to be the vacuum state initially, what kind of state that is later on. Yeah. Any questions today?
Yeah, I might have lost track of where what was infinite and what was countably infinite and all of that stuff. Could any state, is it true that any state is a vacuum state in the right, yeah, that there's a transformation that leads it to the vacuum state?
No, that's not the case.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But that's a different question to what you said earlier, right? Difference between countable and not countable infinite?
It's not related.
It's not related, no. The thing is, the Stone von Neumann theorem says that already if you have finitely many pairs of degrees of freedom, it doesn't apply.
Okay, right.
And of course, also not when it's uncountably many.
Yeah. I had a question about the superconductivity analogy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was maybe I'm ignorant with statistical physics, but there's a whole theory of discontinuous or jump phase transitions.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see what the argument here, or what are you poking at? Is it a phenomenological theory or is it not?
No, I'm just saying that in order to have a clean phase transition like that, in principle, the object needs to be infinite. If you had just a finite object, you could describe it with linear algebra and you wouldn't get a non-analytic function.
And so that, because of the finitude argument means that it has to be smooth and continuous?
Yes.
So you are basically saying that because every linear map on the finite dimensional space is continuous, something like that?
Yeah, but concretely, it's this business, right? That if you just take copies of the system and you compare the state A, tensor A, tensor A, tensor A, to the state B, tensor B, tensor B, tensor B, the overlap becomes smaller and smaller. So eventually it's zero. And then suddenly, they're orthogonal. And so suddenly, the vector B, tensor B, tensor B, tensor B, contains no component of the vector A, tensor A, tensor A. That makes things different.
Also, for these non-equivalent representations, where you have tensor A, tensor A, and tensor B, and then that's equal to alpha to the n,
yeah.
Does that mean that if n is finite, you're technically violating unitarity?
No, not if n is finite.
Not if n is finite.
Oh, no, no, but wait, just a sec.
Yeah.
Unitary transformations are always preserving the angle between two vectors. But we're not going from a system of n particles to a system of n plus 1 particles by unitary transformation. We are discarding the previous system and we are looking at the new system. You're right. Unitaries would preserve all inner products.
Maybe my question doesn't make sense, but let's see. So as a mathematician, seeing all this description, I would say so at the end of the day, it looks like particles are a purely mathematical concept because it all boils down to a chain of bases. But as a physicist, like an experimental physicist would say, okay, but I go to the lab, I hear a click, I see a number, this represents a particle, right? So how you can consolidate those two views? I don't know.
But there's a friction there. Particle physicists will tell you exactly that. Oh, we only ever see particles. But in cosmology, when you look at, for example, the temperature fluctuations in the CMB, it's not a natural. There's no natural interpretation of this being due to particles. It's due to fields. It's due to the impact that the quantum fluctuations of the Klein-Gordon field had on the energy momentum tensor and therefore on the expansion rate of the universe. And yeah, you can't say that this is the detection of particles. Yeah. See, essentially, when we measure particles, what we do is what is also described by unruly detectors. You have an excited field comes in, and then it excites, for example, an atom. Or another elementary particle goes into yet another elementary particle. And that's why we describe this in terms of clicks, things happening in this way. But quantum fields can act differently too. They can contribute, for example, to the energy momentum tensor, which is on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Right? And that's a different way in which particles impact things. And that's how you have an impact in inflation.
I was thinking more in the sense of the change of bases, because by changing a basis in a space, you can say, oh, now I have five particles associated with these modes, but then you can have like 10 associated with these modes.
Yes, that's right. The concept of particle is shaky, not only because there are cosmological circumstances where we cannot really describe what's going on in terms of a particle picture, but also because, as you say, there are circumstances where two different observers, even in the same physical circumstance, would say that there are different numbers of particles. That would be like the Andrew effect, right? Lecture 8. An accelerated observer would see particles and would get excited as if absorbing particles, while at the same time, somebody who is at rest or inertial thinks that everything is in the vacuum state. And in fact, it looks as if the vacuum state itself is an illusion. It doesn't really exist. And by that, I mean, if you have a generic curved space-time, there probably isn't a state in, let's say, Klein-Gordon theory. There isn't any state in the Hilbert space, which would be such that justifiably you would say, well, there are no particles, right? Where everybody would agree that there are no particles. What you can do at best is say, okay, I pick an observer who is sort of preferred, and we are assuming for such and such reasons that this observer doesn't see particles. And we will get later in this course to a very subtle argument, to a very subtle point about what the vacuum state is. And it boils down to the question of whether we should define the vacuum state as the state of lowest energy or the state of no particles, because there actually exists a difference between the two. And then we will argue that what we should go for is the definition of the vacuum state as the state of no particles for a reasonably chosen observer. And why would it be, why would we want to work with the vacuum state as the no particle state and as the initial state, for example, for some cosmological calculations? And you can think of it this way. Imagine that you have a state with particles in it, and you have a tremendous expansion of the universe. Then, in principle, what you would expect is that the number of particles gets diluted. So the dynamics drives it towards the vacuum state in the sense of having no particles around. Just the average density goes to zero, right? And weirdly, that's not the same as requiring that the energy goes to zero. It's a bit early, but we will go through that in detail. Okay, any more questions? All right, okay, see you on Thursday then.